Dr. William Luther Pierce, 1998. The Russian Economy.
Hello. Every few months for the past several years, I've used this program to warn against the policy of economic globalization, which has been one of the Clinton administration's favorite policies. I pointed out the dangers for America in so-called free trade. In my past discussions of the subject, I focused on America's loss of autonomy, which is an inevitable consequence of unrestricted international trade. That is, when one country is able to produce a class of products and sell them to another country cheaper than that other country can produce them for itself, the industry which produces that class of products will be driven out of existence in the second country. If that class of products is plastic hair curlers, for example, it doesn't matter. But if it's machine tools or some other product essential to an independent economy, the second country loses its autonomy. In view of what's been happening around the world recently, and the repercussions of those happenings on Wall Street, this is probably a good time to point out that when we allow our economy to become closely linked to the economies of less stable countries, then we lose not only our autonomy, but also our own economic stability. It's absolutely crazy for the United States to develop strong economic linkages to countries in Asia or Latin America. Or perhaps I should say, it's treasonous. It's not even good policy to become economically dependent on countries like Russia. The only situation in which any sort of close economic linkage with another country, such as free trade on any significant scale, makes sense is when there is a real community of interests. That is a fundamental and obvious truth, but it is completely ignored by the people pushing for globalization. In order for there to be a community of interests between two countries, in the first place, their populations must be of the same race. Thus, it has been the sheerest folly to tie the U.S. economy to those of Asia and Latin America. The basic industries which have been driven out of the United States because of competition from these non-white areas of the world where wage scales are so different. Our machine tool industry, for example, and our consumer electronics industry were essential to our economy. And now, with the collapsing economies in Asia and Mexico pulling our economy down with them, we can't simply disengage because we no longer have autonomy. With Russia, we at least have racial similarity, but there are other reasons why too close an economic involvement with Russia is not good for us now. The most important of those reasons is the men who are now running Russia. The man out front, of course, is President Boris Yeltsin. But Yeltsin is, like Bill Clinton, a seriously flawed man. He's an alcoholic and a skirt chaser. In fact, he is primarily a clown who also is a good actor, someone who can posture effectively for the television cameras and pull in the votes from the Russian masses. And because of his acting ability, he's been strongly supported by the hard, sober men who, for all practical purposes, own Russia and tell Yeltsin what to do. Unfortunately, the majority of these men are Jews, and many also are gangsters, organized crime bosses. A few days ago, MSNBC posted on the internet a list of what it called Russia's robber barons, the 12 men who own Russia's economy, along with brief biographical sketches of each of these newly made billionaires. It's interesting to note that none of these billionaires had as much as $10,000 to his name 10 years ago. They all became enormously wealthy during the so-called privatization of the Russian economy after the collapse of communism at the beginning of this decade. Of these 12 robber barons listed by MSNBC, 8 are Jews. 8 out of 12. That is indeed remarkable in a country with only about 0.5% Jews in its population. Not only that, but the Jews are constantly whining in their media about how they're being persecuted in Russia. They own the country, and they whine to us about Russian anti-Semitism. Of course, MSNBC won't tell you about the Jewishness of any of these robber barons. MSNBC calls them all Russians. But in fact, Boris Berezovsky, Vladimir Glusinski, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, Vitaly Malkin, Mikhail Friedman, Alexander Smolensky, Vladimir Vinogradov, and Anatoly Chubais are Jews, self-acknowledged Jews, bragged about as Jews in the Jewish community publications that we aren't supposed to see. One of the 12, one, Vladimir Potanin, is actually a Russian. One is probably an Azerbaijani, and I haven't yet been able to determine the ethnicity of the remaining two. Before MSNBC's list of 12 robber barons was posted, the Russians had their own list, the 7 oligarchs, they called them, all of them new billionaires who have backed Boris Yeltsin with money and media support. The 7 are the aforenamed Boris Berezovsky, Vladimir Glusinski, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, Mikhail Friedman, Alexander Smolensky, and Pyotr Avin, who is also a Jew, and the Russian Vladimir Potanin. That's 6 Jewish oligarchs and 1 Russian. Let me tell you how this bizarre and very dangerous situation came about. When the Bolsheviks overthrew the Russian government in 1917, murdered the Tsar and his family, and formed the Soviet Union, there was an extraordinarily high quota of Jews among the communist revolutionaries who formed the Soviet government. Lenin, who was himself only a quarter Russian, had surrounded himself with Jews from the beginning. Lenin's chief financier during the revolutionary period was the Jew Israel Lazarevich Helfand, who used the pseudonym Parvus. Lenin's right-hand man was the Jew Grigory Apfelbaum, who used the name Zinoviev. After the revolution, the Jew Lev Bronstein, who used the name Trotsky, became the commissar of the Red Army. The Jew Maxim Litvinov became the best-known Soviet diplomat and the ambassador to Britain. Jews were very thick in Lenin's secret police and in every other branch of his communist government. After Lenin's stroke incapacitated him in 1922, the government was run by a coalition of 3 communists, Stalin, Zinoviev, and Leo Rosenfeld, who used the Russian-sounding name Kamenev. Although Stalin, who was a Georgian, was surrounded by Jews almost to the extent Lenin had been, he managed to play the Jews off against each other. He outmaneuvered Zinoviev, Kamenev, Trotsky, and all the rest, and eventually came out on top. It undoubtedly was to his advantage during this power struggle that the Russian people detested the Jews from centuries of bitter experience with them. Before Stalin became the undisputed boss of the Kremlin, the Jews had pretty well monopolized the entire Soviet bureaucracy. And even though Stalin began thinning them out a bit in the late 1930s, the Second World War came along before he had time to do much. And before he got around to continuing his program of de-Judaizing the Soviet bureaucracy after the war, he died, with a little help from his right-hand Jew, Lazar Kaganovich, who later bragged that he had saved the Jews by poisoning Stalin. So the Soviet bureaucracy remained heavily loaded with Jews right up until the collapse of communism, although they tried not to be too conspicuous, usually occupying the second-rank positions where they wouldn't be so visible. During the communist period, Jews monopolized not only the Soviet government, but also organized crime, black market operations, illegal currency transactions, large-scale theft of public property. Undoubtedly, the Jewish organized crime bosses had intelligence, organizational skills, and perhaps more of a nose for money than their Russian counterparts. But what gave them their real advantage over the Russians was collaboration from their fellow Jews inside the government. Knowing what the secret police knew and what the secret police planned to do provided a real edge for the Jewish gang bosses. Communism collapsed when the communists had bled dry the countries they were ruling and there was no more blood to suck. What would have been most beneficial then would have been the violent overthrow of the various communist regimes by the exploited Russians, Poles, Hungarians, Bulgarians, and so on, with a general massacre of the communists and their collaborators by the people. This also would have amounted to an ethnic cleansing of Eastern Europe, putting a final end to Jewish mischief there. But instead, what happened nearly everywhere was that the communists realized the game was up, and they simply switched hats, declaring themselves Democrats instead of communists. In many cases, the same people continued to hold the same jobs in the government that they had held before, and they continued to collaborate with the same people outside the government that they had collaborated with as communists. So when the privatization of the communist economies took place, that is, the sale of factories, mines, refineries, and other government-run enterprises to private entrepreneurs, much of the wealth of each country suddenly appeared in Jewish hands. In Russia, for example, instead of giving groups of Russian workers an opportunity to buy shares in the factories where they worked, bureaucrats in many cases arranged sweetheart deals with people outside the government they already had been collaborating with. These collaborators got to buy big chunks of the Russian economy at bargain basement prices. That's how virtually all of Russia's new billionaires, and many of Russia's new millionaires as well, got their start in this decade. And that's why at least two-thirds of these new billionaires are Jews. At least two-thirds, in a country where the Jews make up only 0.5% of the population. Jews are smart and often are clever businessmen, but in Russia, it has been crookedness rather than business efficiency which has led to their sudden success in the post-communist era. They virtually stole Russia from the Russians. And because organized crime already was in the hands of the Jews, many of Russia's new Jewish businessmen also are gangsters. Jewish billionaire Boris Berezovsky has been described by Forbes magazine as the godfather of Jewish organized crime in Russia. He speeds around Moscow in an armored limousine accompanied by an army of bodyguards. He has survived several assassination attempts and is said to be responsible for the disappearance of several of his business rivals. Berezovsky certainly seems to be the Jew who has the strongest grip on Boris Yeltsin. He likes to boast that he's the man who got Yeltsin elected to the presidency. Actually, all of the Jews in Russia supported Yeltsin. The Jews in the United States did too. Yeltsin plays a role in Russia similar to the role played in America by Clinton. After Yeltsin's second election in 1996, he appointed Berezovsky to the National Security Council, which supervises Russia's military and police organizations. When it became public knowledge that Berezovsky is an Israeli citizen, however, Yeltsin was obliged to dismiss him. Russian patriots were outraged that an Israeli citizen should be in charge of Russia's national security. Jews, of course, complained that Russian anti-Semitism was responsible for Berezovsky's dismissal. One might ask, how do the Jews get away with it? Why do the Russian people tolerate them? And the answer is that they get away with it in Russia, the same way they get away with it in America. They control the news and entertainment media. And with this media control, they not only swing elections to whichever candidate best suits them, but they also keep most of the ordinary citizens distracted, confused, and hypnotized. Berezovsky, for example, controls Russia's biggest television network, ORT, as well as a number of newspapers and magazines. Vladimir Gusinsky, who also is the president of the Russian Jewish Congress, and like Berezovsky, an Israeli citizen, owns Russia's second largest television network and a number of newspapers and magazines, as well as one of Russia's largest banks. When Jews buy control of the mass media, they always have more than just making money in mind. I don't mean to lead you to believe that the Jews control everything in Russia. In addition to the Jews, there are many Russian criminals in organized crime in Russia, for example. The thug who comes by your shop to collect the weekly protection payment from you and to smash your shop window if you don't have it is more likely to be a Russian than a Jew. But the man who pays the thug to come by your shop is more likely to be a Jew than a Russian. Jews control the rackets, and it is Jewish influence which prevents the Russian government from cracking down on organized crime. Organized crime by itself takes a huge toll on the Russian economy. Crime is an unproductive activity, and it operates on an enormous scale in Russia. And because so many of Russia's new Jewish businessmen also are involved in organized crime, business in Russia tends to be even more predatory than it is in the West. The concept of serving the community or serving the nation with their business activity is completely alien to these Jewish businessmen. Their only aim is to acquire as much money and power as they possibly can, as quickly as they can. Not only do they have no patriotic feeling at all toward Russia, but they are positively hostile to any expression of patriotism by the real Russians. This sort of business attitude, the sort of business climate associated with this attitude, does not result in a really stable economy, of course. The irresponsible and unpatriotic attitudes and business practices of Russia's Jewish tycoons are the main reason for Russia's present economic collapse. Unlike the situation in the United States, where every major politician is politically correct and every element of the mass media toes the party line, in Russia, there are political leaders who do speak out against the Jews, and there are general circulation publications which do criticize them. Some journalists, for instance, like to refer to Boris Berezovsky using his patronymic, that is, his middle name, which is Abramovich. They call him Boris Abramovich. They do this not only to embarrass and irritate Berezovsky, but to remind the Russian people that he is a Jew, a Yid, not a Russian. In one way, Russia has an advantage over the United States, and that is that the Russian people are much less comfortable. While Jewish billionaires and millionaires buzz around Moscow in their armored limousines, flashing their diamonds and furs, most ordinary Russians have a hard time putting enough on the table to eat. The recent devaluation of the ruble and the run on Russia's banks is making things even harder on the Russians. And it may be that not even the Jews' control of the television networks will suffice to save them from the well-deserved wrath of the Russian people. And that's the whole reason behind Mr. Clinton's recent trip to the Kremlin to hold Mr. Yeltsin's hand. The people who sent Clinton to Moscow don't care at all about the welfare of the Russian people. But they are worried that if the Russian economy gets much worse, the Russian people may take it out on Berezovsky, Gusinsky, and the rest. And that, of course, is exactly why it is not in our interest to bail out the Russian economy. What Russia needs is a cure for its long-term problem, not another Band-Aid. And the only thing which will cure Russia is a thorough program of ethnic cleansing, which leaves Boris Abramovich and all of his fellow tribesmen hanging from lampposts all over Russia. An ethnic cleansing which is sudden and sharp and absolutely thorough. That is what is in our long-term interest. A Russia under the control of the Russian people again, our people, after more than 80 years of alien domination. The Russian people are, like the American people, quite passive by nature. It takes a lot to rouse them to do the difficult things they need to do. But the more uncomfortable they become, the more likely they are to take action. Let's not help the thieves who have stolen Russia stay in power by propping up the Russian economy. You know, some people who want us to keep Berezovsky and his pals in power warn us that if we don't prop up Boris Yeltsin and the Russian economy, the communists will take over again. And that may be so. And you know what I think about communists. I believe that they all should be shot. But it will be better for the Russian people and for us, for the Communist Party to regain power in Russia, than for the crowd around Yeltsin to keep power. Communism is based on two fundamental errors. It assumes that people are all born basically the same. That is, communism is egalitarian. And it stifles the great driving force of every healthy economy, which is the quest for private gain. And because it is based on error, it certainly is not a system that we want to impose on any of our people, in Russia or elsewhere. But the people around Yeltsin, the robber barons, the oligarchs, are eating Russia alive. And even communism, so long as it is Russian communism and not Jewish communism, is better than continued rule by Jewish plutocrats. It's interesting to note that even the Russian patriots, the Russian nationalists, agree with me on this matter. They are willing to make an alliance, at least a temporary alliance, with the communists in order to get the blood-sucking, culture-destroying Jews off Russia's back. Ultimately, of course, we want to see genuine nationalists guiding our people everywhere. If the Russians become hungry enough and exasperated enough to break the grip of the Abramoviches, perhaps similar developments will follow in Bulgaria, Hungary, and the other countries where Jewish Bolsheviks were permitted to simply change hats and declare themselves Democrats a few years ago when it became unsafe for them to continue wearing their communist hats. But it really will take a nationalist revolution in Russia to bring that about. And we don't want to do anything to discourage that. Meanwhile, I hope my comments today have helped you understand a little better what is behind Mr. Clinton's recent trip to the Kremlin. Thanks for being with me again today.